Case number 19-2212, Mark McQueen versus Obel Wynn. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Melissa Salinas, supervising attorney. The case to be argued by law students Sumner Truax and Sophia Montgomery.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Melissa Salinas, and I have the honor of supervising and introducing law students Sumner Truax and Sophia Montgomery. They will be representing Mr. McQueen in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Sumner Truax, and I'm here this morning with Sophia Montgomery on behalf of with the court's permission, I'd like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That is fine, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mark McQueen was subjected to a system that deprived him of an effective lawyer at trial, it deprived him of an effective lawyer on appeal, and then it used his appellate attorney's ineffectiveness to deny him the opportunity to demonstrate that his lawyers were, in fact, ineffective. This court should grant Mr. McQueen relief and should order either an evidentiary hearing in the federal district court or remand to the state courts for a new appeal so that he can finally have the opportunity to demonstrate his attorney's ineffectiveness. Now, all of these claims should be reviewed de novo by this court. And the reason is that 2254D is inapplicable because no state court decision, or the last reasoned state court decision, I should say, did not deny those claims on merits grounds. It denied them on procedural grounds. And what that means is that if the reason for the denial as an adequate and independent state ground, then the claims are procedurally defaulted. They were not adjudicated on the merits. Now, the problem that the state faces here is that Mr. McQueen's ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim is not, in fact, procedurally defaulted, because as this court said in Guillemette, 6.508D3 cannot apply to a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And with respect to the trial counsel claims, this court should review those de novo.
The appellate counsel claim, I'm confused about, though. If it couldn't have been procedurally barred, then it was barred on the merits, right? I mean, he didn't prevail on it. So either the Michigan Court of Appeals denied it on the merits, or if we look through to the state trial court decision, that would have been a merits denial, right?
So, no, Your Honor. I think we start with the Michigan Supreme Court opinion, which says very clearly that the leave for appeal is denied because the defendant or the applicant has failed to show his burden under 6.508D. Now, under Yields and under Harrington versus Richter, that is the last reasoned state court opinion. And so to the extent we do any kind of limited look through, which this court has required in Guillemette, and that's to the Michigan Court of Appeals order, which cites specifically 6.508D3. And we know from Caesar and Guillemette that when ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims are erroneously barred, then it's reviewed de novo. That's exactly what this court did in both of those cases, and it's what it should do again here. So when we look at the merits of the claims de novo, trial counsel was ineffective under Strickland in two ways. First, when he failed to investigate and call an expert that he himself had recognized was necessary for the case, and when he failed to investigate and call an alibi witness. And appellate counsel was ineffective when she failed to raise these two significant and obvious claims. Now, one remedy is for this court to reverse the district court and to order an evidentiary hearing because under Michael Williams, E2 is inapplicable to this case because Mr. McQueen diligently developed the factual record in state court. The district court was free to hold an evidentiary hearing, and it did not do so. I'll begin by addressing counsel's ineffectiveness with respect to the Dr. Oprah claim. The record is clear that trial counsel believed that Dr. Oprah's testimony was necessary. The record's also clear that the trial judge agreed that Dr. Oprah's testimony was necessary. And finally, the record is equally clear that appellate counsel had a strategy of discrediting AM's testimony or calling into question her credibility. And despite that strategy, failed to raise this claim that was facially obvious and significant on the record. And
counsel,
so,
weren't all the points that Dr. Oakloak would have said, weren't they brought out in cross-examination?
Your Honor, no. We don't believe that they were. Part of the challenge here, of course, is because of appellate counsel's failure and trial counsel's failure, we don't know precisely what Dr. Oakloak would have said, but we do know that in the case People versus Owens, which trial counsel cites in his request for an expert, that case also involved Dr. Oakloak, and there she would have testified about the limitations of the forensic interviewing process. That's exactly what trial counsel mentioned in his request for Dr. Oakloak. That's what he said she would have testified to. And cross-examination here is an insufficient substitute for that. The reality is that we're talking about a case where the credibility, not just of AM, but of the entire forensic interviewing process, is central to the state's case. And there's a big difference between having an expert child psychologist deconstruct the process of a forensic interview with a child witness, and having counsel, who again himself admitted that he wouldn't be ineffective if not calling that expert to deconstruct that, cross-examine. I mean, the reality is that juries don't know about, they don't understand forensic interviewing. It's beyond the intent of the jury, and that's why an expert was necessary here. And that's also why the trial court agreed with that and granted funds for Mr. McQueen to hire an expert. So under Chase versus McCauley, I think it's fairly clear that with respect to this claim, appellate counsel missed a significant and obvious claim in the record and was objectively deficient. With respect to prejudice, I think that all that's required for prejudice here is a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And on both appeal and with respect to the trial counsel claims, there is a reasonable probability. If appellate counsel had requested a Ginther hearing on appeal, almost certainly would have been a Ginther hearing. The standard for a Ginther hearing is relatively capacious. It simply requires that there are factual issues regarding defendant's counsel's performance that require further inquiry. And here, there certainly are those questions. And an evidentiary hearing or a Ginther hearing in the state courts would have resolved that. With respect to the trial counsel claims, for the reasons I just kind of laid out about the limitations of the forensic interview process, the centrality of the forensic interviewing process, the lack of physical evidence that directly connects Mr. McQueen to the crime. This is a case that really turned on credibility. And the fact that Mr. McQueen was denied because of his trial attorney's and appellate attorney's failure was denied the opportunity to really call the complaining witness's credibility into question, that's prejudicial. And that's why this court should reverse and order either an evidentiary hearing in the federal district court or remand to the state courts.
Let me ask you about the alibi witness, purported alibi witness who was not called, this Archie McQueen. As I understand it, Mr. McQueen's trial attorney, did call an alibi witness, Mr. McQueen's girlfriend, Tawana Patterson, and she testified that she had spent the afternoon, evening, when this incident purportedly occurred with McQueen. But Archie McQueen would have testified to a whole different set of circumstances and events on that particular day. Wouldn't that testimony have been in conflict with testimony of Ms. Patterson? It would give the jury two competing versions of where Mr. McQueen was on the date in question when the crime occurred.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, we don't believe that they're fully in conflict. We think that they're instead, the proper way to view it is complementary. The precise timing of the alleged incident is unclear. on the record. AM was not clear about that. That wasn't elicited at any point in throughout the trial. And it's true that Tawana Patterson, Mr. McQueen's fiance, did testify about that she was with him that day, she was with him that evening. Archie McQueen would have testified about much later in the evening, a much later period of time. And I think that, you know, again, the Archie McQueen thing, we've got to consider the context here, which is that when we're talking about credibility, this court has already found that failure to call alibi witnesses can be ineffective assistance of counsel. And Archie McQueen would have testified that he was at a party with Mark McQueen. And what that, you know, I think it's fair to say that if counsel is faced with the possibility of calling a single witness, and I see my time has expired.
You may just finish your answer briefly.
Just that at a party, Your Honor, had counsel investigated Archie, it likely would have yielded far more witnesses than the single witness of Tawana Patterson, and that would have allowed Mr. McQueen to more fully bolster his alibi for that evening. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear next from Mr. Palace.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, my name is John Palace, Assistant Attorney General from the State of Michigan. I represent the respondent appellee in this case, Warden Nguyen. First things first, I'd like to say that even if McQueen is correct that AEDPA's direct deferential standard does not apply to any of the three certified claims that were certified by this court for review, the state still will prevail. That is because even stripped of AEDPA deference, so-called Strickland deference carries the day on all three claims. That is because the Strickland standard itself is a general standard, which is very highly deferential. So in other words, even on de novo review, Strickland requires wide latitude to be given to the decisions and actions of counsel, whether trial counsel or appellate counsel, and we prevail anyway. And this was the approach taken by the district court in this case, and it's really not a bad one. It resolves the matter without having to address the thornier questions of whether defaults apply, whether or not there's merit by the state courts. And the district court's point is well taken that under de novo Strickland review, McQueen cannot prevail. I can understand why the district court decided to take that approach, and it's certainly an option for this court. In any event, we believe for the reasons that I'm about to discuss that AEDPA deference applies to all three ineffective assistance of counsel claims, the two trial counsel claims, as well as the sole appellate counsel claim for failure to raise the two trial counsel claims. And let me just begin that analysis by responding to something that Mr. Truax said about what the last reason state court decision is in this case. The Michigan Supreme Court did, in fact, deny the motion for relief from judgment appeal for failure to meet the requirements of 6508D. The problem with that order, then, is that under the Gilmette case, is considered an ambiguous order, and we have to look through to the next order to see whether what was really happening. And there's no doubt that the Michigan Court of Appeals, as Mr. Truax correctly noted, issued a decision in this case where they denied the application for leave to appeal containing these three claims, citing Michigan Court Rule 6508D3. Now, that's indisputably a procedural default. Now, if all we were talking about, if that was the end of what the Michigan Court of Appeals order did, then we would be talking about procedural default, and I don't think I'd have a claim that AEDPA did apply here. But there's something that the Michigan Court of Appeals did in its order denying the application, in addition to denying the application. It separately denied McQueen's motion to remand for an evidentiary hearing on his motion that he filed in addition to his application for leave to appeal in the Michigan Court of Appeals. And case law is clear in this circuit. A denial of a motion for evidentiary hearing containing ineffective assistance of counsel claims is presumed to be an adjudication on the merits of those claims. And that's the Nally versus Phillips case cited in our brief. It's a case that's been followed by several panels of this court as well as by some of the district courts here in Michigan. Now, McQueen has tried to distinguish Nally and other cases like it by arguing that in those cases, The Court of Appeals denied the motions for evidentiary hearing, quote, for failure to persuade the court of the need to remand the case, whereas here the Michigan Court of Appeals was simply said it was, quote unquote, denying the motion for evidentiary hearing. In our opinion, that's a distinction without a difference. If anything, simply denying the motion to remand for an evidentiary hearing appears to be more of an adjudication on the merits than saying the prisoners failed to demonstrate the need for a remand. Again, a distinction without a difference. McQueen has not shown anything that overcomes the presumption that the denial of his motion for an evidentiary hearing constitutes a merits adjudication of his ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Now, why does it matter so much whether AEDPA deference applies and whether there's a merits adjudication? Well, first of all, there's the double deference that's afforded when AEDPA and Strickland come into play together. The two of them in tandem provide an extraordinarily high level of deference. And then all of this talk about evidentiary hearings, the federal district court cannot expand the record of the case beyond what it was in the state courts at the time it made its decision by evidentiary hearing or otherwise, if there is a merits adjudication of the claim. So that's why it's so important that there actually is AEDPA deference here. Although, like I said, even on de novo review, we should prevail. Now, turning to the actual ineffective assistance of counsel claims themselves, and I'll start with the trial counsel claims, there's the failure to call Dr. Okla. Now, McQueen repeatedly states in his brief that trial counsel had obtained the funding to hire Dr. Okla as an expert to counter the prosecution's experts, and that he even said something along the lines of that he would be ineffective if he didn't call an expert like Dr. Okla. Now, that the other side makes a lot of hay of that, or tries to make a lot of hay of that, but the one thing that we all have to keep in mind here is that Strickland is an objective standard, not a subjective standard. So what his own opinion of his own competence is really not relevant here. And in keeping with Strickland's presumption of correctness, again, even just on de novo review, one has to assume that if counsel obtained the funding to obtain an expert, something must have happened between that point and when trial occurred to change his mind on calling his own expert to the stand in the defense case. And counsel's performance, simply because he changed his mind, apparently, does not mean he was deficient. And I think, as we said in our brief, and we quote from Richter,
their argument is not just that he changed. I mean, it's not just that he changed his mind; it's that he didn't even talk to her, right? I mean, isn't that the claim, that the attorney didn't bother to talk to the person or follow up before making a decision about whether to call the person as a witness or not?
Yes, that's true. That is a component of the claim. However, I think there's some dispute here about whether or not the attorney actually did contact Dr. Okla. Now, there is a letter from Dr. Okla that was attached to the prisoner's motion for relief from judgment where she indicates that she had no contact with counsel. And that seems to indicate that there may not have been contact between counsel and Dr. Okla. That's not entirely clear from the record of this case. But let's even just assume for a second that maybe there wasn't a good reason for not calling Dr. Okla. I think as one of the judges indicated when Mr. Truax was speaking, the trial counsel did a pretty effective job of taking the prosecution's expert witness to task. I mean, right off the bat, if you look at the transcript, right off the bat in his cross-examination of the prosecutor's expert, he presents her with the protocol that she's talking about, and he kind of almost sarcastically talks about the price of that protocol being somewhat around $2 or something to that effect. He gets her to say that she followed it, but then gets her to admit that she didn't follow the protocol's recommendation that victim interviews be videotaped. I mean, that's pretty damaging. And there were just other ways that he effectively, not a long cross-examination by reading it, but effectively really did what maybe Dr. Okla would have accomplished anyway. And here's the thing that we have to bear in mind. We have no idea what Dr. Okla would have testified to had she been called as a witness. I mean, it's entirely possible that if he did contact her, that they discussed the case and there was a determination that she had nothing of value to add to the case, so that's why he didn't call her. McQueen says in his state post-conviction affidavit that was attached to his motion for relief from judgment, that she would, quote, have testified and rebutted Carehouse doctor Margot Maltmaker's interview techniques and how unduly suggestive and unreliable it is. But what is that based on? That's really just pure conjecture. It's certainly nothing from Dr. Okla. There's no affidavit. There's no statement from her. And again, even if we're not talking about EDPA deference.
Was there a, my understanding is there is no videotape of the interview. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So she would have had to make that evaluation based on something that was not actually the interview itself, right?
That's correct. There wouldn't have been the visual cues, and I think the kind of thing that would have maybe helped Dr. Okla opine. I mean, that didn't happen here.
But isn't it?
Now, and the fact that the video wasn't taken, I'm sorry.
I do find it a little bit, maybe not troubling, but I don't know. I take it you wouldn't agree that cross-examination of the other person's expert is always going to be an adequate substitute for having your own. I mean, there's a difference between putting your own person on the stand, and you know, it's kind of the, you know, you can't beat something with nothing. I mean, it kind of behooves you to have your own person. So I don't know. I guess I'm curious what you think. What the limits would be on when cross-examination is an adequate substitute. Is it just a matter of looking at the actual examination and saying, oh, this guy did a pretty good job, I think it's a substitute here?
I would agree with Judge Nalbandian, and yes. And I think no less than the U.S. Supreme Court has said that Strickland does not enact Newton's third law for the presentation of evidence, requiring for every prosecution expert an equal and opposite expert from the defense. So, you know, I think you have to take every case on its facts. I think the trial counsel did, you know, a short, and I'll admit, not a very long cross-examination, but a highly effective one. And my point is that when you take that in conjunction with the fact that we really don't know what Dr. Okla would have testified to, I mean, the letter that she wrote to the prisoner doesn't say what she would have said. His allegation in his own affidavit isn't supported with anything. Again, we're talking about presumptions of competence, presumption that counsel did as he should have done. But let's even get past that for a moment. If we talk about assuming even that there was deficient performance by not calling that expert that he had obtained expert funds for, our brief lays out the strength of the evidence against McQueen, and I'm not going to belabor talking about the evidence. It wasn't simply just a credibility contest between AM and McQueen. And there's something that the state court said at sentencing that struck me as I was preparing for this oral argument, is that at sentencing, the state trial court said at page ID 847 that the recorded phone call where McQueen asked the victim for her forgiveness and told her that he had effed up was a big deal to them, quote unquote, a big deal to the jury, because the judge himself had spoken to the jury apparently after their verdict. Now, the judge doesn't mention anything about the case falling or rising on the prosecution's expert or lack of a defense expert for that matter. It really sounds like what got this jury convinced and what got this jury to believe AM was the fact that the defendant's own words in this recorded telephone conversation, where he basically asks for her forgiveness and says that he effed up. And the judge says, again, that was a big deal to the jury. So even if there was deficient performance, there is no prejudice from the failure to call Dr. Okla as a defense witness. Now, I'm going to turn now briefly to talk about Archie McQueen, who's the alleged alibi witness. And I think it was brought out by one of the judges when Mr. Truex is speaking, that doesn't necessarily jive with the story that the defense was presenting. And what Mr. McQueen, Archie McQueen, would have said is that he was with the prisoner late into the evening on Sunday night at a rap party, at which time the victim originally said that the sexual abuse occurred.
Now, briefly, I just want to, I'd be remiss if I didn't say anything, and I certainly don't want to ambush anybody with anything, and please be assured that's not my intent here. But when I was looking at the circuit court docket entries for this case, I came across something that was kind of interesting. Apparently, on the same day, and this is in the docket entries in page ID 298, apparently on the very same day that the jury came back with its verdict, the docket entries indicate that an order of contempt was issued for a person named Archie McQueen, found in contempt of court, sentenced to 3 days in the Macomb County Jail to be released Sunday, 7/24/11, taken into custody. So, you know, to me, that struck me as odd. I mean, there's more to this. There's something more about this Archie McQueen individual. It tells me a couple of things, first of all, that Archie was clearly present at least during part of this trial, or something happened that he ended up getting held in contempt for. He obviously engaged in some kind of bad behavior in connection with this case, which led the court not just to hold him in contempt of court, but on top of it, to sentence him to 3 days in jail.
Is this really relevant to our argument, the issue before us today?
The reason I would believe it would be relevant would be that it might impact Mr. Archie McQueen's credibility. I mean, it sounds like this is the type of person that's going to get held in contempt by a court. How believable would that witness have been? Now, again, it's a lot of this is speculation, but again, we have to make some presumptions here.
I guess for my purposes, I see your time's expiring. I would rather you address the sort of the underlying issue in terms of whether these alibis are in conflict. And I see your time has expired, but maybe you could take 30 seconds to do that.
I will, Judge Cole. Thank you. I think because the defense called Tawana Peterson, who was the prisoner's girlfriend, to say that, look, the children were taken back to their grandmother on Sunday evening. So that the original timeline during which the victim says this occurred on a Sunday night, it couldn't possibly have happened on a Sunday night because the children were back with their grandmother. That's why the lack of having Archie McQueen talk about what happened Sunday night is okay because Tawana Peterson says the children were not there Sunday night anyway. So it's duplicative. Since my time's up, I won't say anything further about that, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions about trial counsel or appellate counsel that this panel might have.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Pallas. And we will hear rebuttal from Sophia Montgomery.
Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. Sophia Montgomery for the petitioner, Mr. McQueen. I'd like to make two main points in response. And the first is that not every habeas case brought by a state prisoner in federal court is an AEDPA case. AEDPA is a deferential regime, but it is inapplicable whereas here there has been no process for fully and fairly litigating the claims in state court. And second, where there isn't anything to defer to from the state courts. And that's the case here because, as my co-counsel discussed, the Michigan Supreme Court used a procedural rule to dispose of all of the claims in one fell swoop. And as a result, all of Mr. McQueen's claims that have been certified for appeal by this court should be reviewed de novo. I'd also like to discuss the unique importance of the expert and how that helps Mr. McQueen demonstrate prejudice in this case. So the gaps in the record in this case are tied to the specific failures of trial and appellate counsel. The record isn't as fully developed as we'd like. We don't have, you know, four expert affidavits, pro bono experts in the state post-conviction record as in the Caesar case, but we do have enough for prejudice, or at least to remand for a hearing on prejudice. First, I want to just take care to frame the credibility issue here as whether the jury believed AM's account as it was shored up by the state. And the forensic interview is critical to that. Trial counsel said in his motion that Dr. Oakley was necessary as an expert to testify to the limitations of the forensic interview process. For that proposition, he cited a Michigan state case, the Owens case, which Mr. Truex also briefly mentioned.
What is your response, though? So the interview wasn't available to his expert. So what was Dr. Okla gonna, how was she gonna evaluate the interview techniques or any of that without the videotape? Wasn't the cross-examination of the other, of the state's expert, the best way for the defense to try the case then at that point?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, no. I mean, for all, there may have been a transcript, but even if there hadn't, Dr. Okla could have heard the way that Margo Moltmaker, who's not a doctor, discussed the interview, and she could have, Dr. Okla could have discussed what was inconsistent about the interview and other things that AM had said. She could have explained things about the questions that were suggestive. And actually, I think the Owens case here is particularly on point because in that case, as here, there was, for example, the suggestion of a potentially biased parent who tainted the interview. That was also true that was on the record, you know, in the trial transcripts and everything, in this case with AM's mother. So that was something that Dr. Okla in Owens could have testified to, and the same is true here. And not to mention the fact that simply the reason that we hire experts in the first place is that it is fundamentally different to have counsel cross-examine a state's witness than to have an expert be able to, who was intricately, you know, familiar with these kinds of techniques, who is an expert child psychologist, testify about what was problematic about this interviewing technique. I also just like to note that the Caesar case is really incredibly instructive and is a helpful roadmap here for why the relief that Mr. McQueen is requesting is so appropriate for the specific injury and procedural problem that has occurred here. Both of these cases are fundamentally about trial counsel recognizing the need for an expert because of the centrality of a kind of testimony that implicated particular reliability issues, but then failing to do anything about it. And this court, in the Caesar case, specifically said that the failure to investigate or take steps toward procuring this expert was especially unreasonable because counsel had told the defendant about the need for the expert. And the same happened here, except trial counsel also told the trial court, which agreed. That's not to say that any time that counsel says on the record, I would be ineffective for failing to do X, they automatically are. But it does, in this case, serve as evidence of what Dr. Okla would have testified to. It definitely serves to demonstrate how significant and obvious this claim was, yet appellate counsel then went on not to raise it, and so helps us demonstrate the cause and prejudice prongs of the Strickland inquiry for both the IATC and IAAC claims.
Counsel, what do you anticipate presenting? Would you have Dr. Okla testify at this hearing if we remanded it for a hearing on prejudice?
I think that would certainly be the first sort of goal and preference. I think that because of the fact there hasn't been an evidentiary hearing yet, there hasn't been any outreach to her, but certainly her or another kind of child psychologist would be, that would be necessary and certainly the first thing that we would try to do in either state or federal court.
Shouldn't we, as a predicate to ordering a hearing, actually have something from Dr. Okla in the record telling us what she would say? That's what's troubling me here. We just don't really have enough from her as to what she would testify to at the hearing that could make a difference.
I understand that concern, Your Honor. I think that in this case, I think it's important to know all the steps that Mr. McQueen took from his jail cell to procure testimony, the testimony that he would seek to introduce at this hearing, the fact that he requested an evidentiary hearing. You know, his efforts were closed off and rebuffed again and again by the state courts, and that's just frankly not the kind of thing that the court should be holding against him. And if that's really the court's, you know, something that the court is extremely concerned with, then remanding to federal court for a federal evidentiary hearing would be an extremely appropriate and tailored remedy. In the Caesar case, this court remanded for a hearing on prejudice in the district court, and that would certainly be appropriate and warranted here in light of those concerns. My time has expired. If there are no further questions, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Montgomery, for your argument, and certainly want to thank all counsel here in this case today for your briefing and your arguments. Mr. Pallas and Ms. Salinas, as the supervising attorney, thank you, but I especially want to thank two students from the University of Michigan Clinic, Mr. Truax and Ms. Montgomery, we know how much effort you put into briefing and preparation for argument, and speaking, you know, for myself, you just did a great job, certainly a service to Mr. McQueen and to the justice system at large. So we appreciate your efforts and thank you, and the case will be submitted.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thanks again. You did a great job. So.